All right, take two. Welcome to the Security Weekly News Wrap-Up for the week of 15 August 2021. Fortinet versus Rapid7 in a Texas cage match. OnlyFans, Cisco, Calais, T-Mobile, and the government. And all this and the show wrap-ups on this edition of Security Weekly News.
This is Security Weekly. For security professionals, by security professionals.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
It's the show that keeps you up to date on the latest security news twice a week. Your trusted source for accurate security information and expert analysis. It's time for Security Weekly News.
Every 11 seconds, there's a new ransomware attack. Oil pipelines, universities, corporations, all paying millions of dollars. Barracuda says, don't pay the ransom. Before a ransomware attack occurs, train your teams to recognize an attack and use anti-phishing technology. Protect your applications, and they can't get onto your network. Simple backup and restore solutions quickly recover your data without paying the ransom. Build your ransomware protection plan now by visiting securityweekly.com/Barracuda. That's securityweekly.com/Barracuda. With the skills gap increasing, it's more important than ever to train your staff effectively and efficiently. Offensive Security provides training for your organization designed by the same minds behind Kali Linux. Here are two recent offerings from OFSEC. OFSEC Academy gives you the chance to earn industry-leading OSCP certification with dedicated one-on-one mentoring. You can also try Proving Grounds Enterprise, created exclusively by Offensive Security's InfoSec experts for highly realistic simulated networks. Visit securityweekly.com/OFSEC to learn more.
All right, I'm your host, Doug White, for the Security Weekly News Wrap-Up Show after an epic show last night. First, let's wrap up all the show topics for the week. On Application Security Weekly number 162, John and Mike had Mike Rothman on the show. Mike is the president and co-founder at Disrupt Ops. And Mike was on basically talking about DevSecOps, as you might guess, on that show. And he wanted to talk about some of the things that security teams can do that's going to immediately add value to the process. And this has been a theme this week, seems like. I know we had a segment last night. We were talking about this on the news, but all this about how to get these DevSecOps or into your AppSec or just into your DevApps group and how you get that in that process. On Business Security Weekly number 228, Jason, Adrian, and Matt welcome Fleming Xu. And Fleming is the CTO at Barracuda Networks and has been on this show before and is always fun to talk to. Fleming was on to talk about this time how Barracuda researchers identified 121 ransomware incidents in the last 12 months, which represents a 64% increase in the number of ransomware attacks over what they were monitoring in the 12 months previously. And he went on and was talking primarily about, despite the fact that a lot of this is targeting cities and towns, that, you know, it's an always shifting landscape where they are always going to be moving and that they are starting to move on to other sectors. So don't get complacent. Don't assume that, you know, they're primarily going after healthcare. They're going everywhere and there's more of them. So the more ransoms that get paid, the more people are going to enter the that marketplace because they go, hey, there's money to be made here. In the second segment, 7 tips for better CISO-CFO relationships. I don't know. I'm going to go read those tips because I want to see what that says. Or I'll go listen to see what they had to say about it. 5 simple tips to help you write a powerful email that gets read. 3, I need to read that one too. 3 strategies to secure your digital supply chain and more. So they always have a bunch of additional news stories. On Enterprise Security Weekly 239, Adrian, Paul, and Tyler Shields had Allie Mellon on, and Allie is an industry analyst at Forrester Research. Allie was talking about how a lot of time is spent looking at the SOC and what kind of tools you need in the SOC to make it more autonomous. You know, now with even more powerful AI. But this particular segment was about how maybe, you know, more automatic and automated AI is not necessarily going to be the answer to having a really good SOC. And I've thought that for a long time. I mean, we all want to seek easy ways out. But unfortunately, at some point, somebody, you need some real eyes on this stuff, because I've just not been, I don't have much faith in that process. In the second segment, Darren Guccione, the CEO and co-founder at Keeper Security, was on. Darren was talking about how cybercrime is insane. So this is similar to that first show, how cybercrime is a shifting and evolutionary problem that is going to continue to evolve. And that creates a shifting and evolutionary problem then for cybersecurity. So he was talking about how to boost your policies and your infrastructure to try and support this brave new world where it's not just the same crime over and over and over again, which is sort of the tradition with physical crime. You know, people have been robbing people at bodegas probably since, you know, cave people, but cybercrime is something that changes on a just almost constant basis. On Security and Compliance Weekly number 83, Flea, Jeff, and Josh had on Naomi Buckwalter, the founder and executive director at Cybersecurity Gatebreakers Foundation. Naomi was talking about the cybersecurity skills gap. And I thought it was a really interesting topic. The cybersecurity skills gap that we hear about all the time in the media and how that's kind of a myth. Naomi felt that there were skills, the skills are there, that we have people, but that we really need more defenders because, you know, attackers are essentially one of my infinite series problems, and a single attack actor could attack an infinite number of companies. I mean, you know, with just a single attack. And since you have an infinite number of attackers with an infinite number of attacks on an infinite number of companies, eventually they all sit down with typewriters and write all the works of Shakespeare or something like that. But she was primarily talking about how do you get skilled people into the right place at the right time? And that I really, when I saw that description, I was like, oh yeah, you're right. I mean, you've got to get the right people here, and you've got to be able to hire and retain the right people, and that's the real challenge. In a second segment, they talked about this some more. On Security Weekly News number 143, Jason Wood talked about a really interesting case that was out there where a attacker broke into Poly Network and stole $600 million in cryptocurrency. They got the wallets. And how Poly Network was offering them a sort of $500,000 tip as an incentive to return all the wallets. It's a really interesting story that was out this week. And I thought, you know, this was, listen to Jason if you're interested in that. On Paul's Security Weekly number 707, up first was the Epic News segment that may now be, they had the three blabbiest hosts, right? Me, Jeff, and Paul. On at the same time, which is always get well soon, Tyler. They had all of us on there, so we ended up talking for a long time. It's a really, really cool segment, lots of fun. So check that out. It's posted. In the second segment, Wheel, a researcher at Qualys, joined Paul and Lee to talk about a size T to int conversion vulnerability in the Linux kernel. So that's a function in a library there. And this was a file system problem that would ultimately affect almost all Linux systems and could lead to, it was basically a way an unprivileged user could get to root pretty easily. Very scary and very cool segment. So if you missed that last night, you should check it out. And in the third segment, Sonali Shah joined Paul. And Sonali is the chief product officer at Invictus Security. And was talking about, and here was another one of these, how shifting left is a good idea, but overall it's an incomplete strategy. So this is sort of, you know, another one of those things where the buzzword gets into the corporate mindset and they say, all we need to do is shift left. And somebody finally says, what does shifting left actually mean? That shifting left is the kind of buzzwordy thing that a lot of times C-suite people are looking to hear, that this will solve all our problems and all our dreams will come true. The segment was basically talking about how modern AppSec techniques can try to reduce breaches and other problems by allowing DevOps and SecOps teams to work together better. Very much in tune with that from my perspective. And I think that just saying we're going to put this in the process is not the same thing as actually breaking down silos and getting people to work together and understand that they are going to work together. My threat of the week is going to be patching again. It just kind of keeps coming back up. It was inspired from reading this article about, and Paul and I don't necessarily agree on a lot of things, but we don't agree on how to pronounce this. He's calling it holes worm. I was calling it hole swarm. Don't know which one is correct. He says because the W is capitalized, it's holes worm. I don't know. But anyway, holes, I'm going to say holes swarm. And you can say whatever you like and call it throat warbler, mangrove, and whatever makes you happy. But basically, it's a crypto miner botnet. And okay, so nothing new there. It's compromised more than 1,000 cloud hosts since June. Well, you know, pretty much nothing new there. And of course, all those were unpatched vulnerabilities that were compromised. Now, the first part of this to me, the reason this story is interesting is that this is a tool. So this is a malware framework type tool that continues to shift its attack based on vulnerabilities it detects. So it's almost a vulnerability scanner. I mean, it is really a vulnerability scanner. It looks for certain vulnerabilities. And if it finds them, it develops an attack and then implements the attack on that particular vulnerability. So evolutionary. So the old way that patching teams operated, at least when I was doing it, was once a week they had a patch meeting, or and it was actually called the prod meeting. So pushing things from dev into prod to get them out into production once a week, and everybody talked about all the dev updates that were coming. And there was an approval officer named Sue. Hi, Sue, if you're still around. Approval officer who sat between the prod and the dev and did not really have any technical skills. So the approval officer did not really know how to read code. The approval officer's job was to see that everything had been tested that was supposed to be tested, and all the little boxes were ticked off and all the interactions were documented and all that kind of stuff. And when they were satisfied that all those pieces of that waterfall model approach had been met, they would commit. And they were the only person that could commit this at that business. In the modern era, I think with cloud, APIs, lambdas, multiple servers, multiple sites, multiple environments that are scattered around the both physical and virtual planet, it really seems to me like that old model is probably not going to work. I'm not sure it ever worked, to be honest, but it was at least something. The big problem I had with that old model was the time. And it was a slower time then. A time of summer days, clean water, buggy rides, and stickball. Pepperidge Farm remembers. But even then, in that simpler time, come back to Simple Rick, the delay between dev and prod was far too long. I mean, this was where, you know, when we got all this pushback for why has this not been fixed, we were saying, well, we can't get it through the approval process. And, you know, that group didn't do their part. This group didn't do their part. I remember I wrote a report once. It was analyzing the amount of time just from we tracked some stuff from prod to from dev to prod. And, you know, we reached the scientific conclusion that it was taking too long. So even with that in that very contained, constrained mainframe environment, the impact, you know, the process didn't really work. Today, the impact of a patch, I mean, it could. You know, it's like some crazy exponential effect of not just a change, but a change that creates a tsunami of change across the world. I mean, you change an API, it could affect, you know, not just stuff within your company, it could affect stuff all over the planet. And I mean, what if you patch print spooler? You know, I mean, this was a big deal lately. So if you patch print spooler, could your organization right now even begin to evaluate this change in that old-fashioned way? I don't think so. I mean, we had to show every system that was going to be impacted by an update or a new product, and we had to put it on a diagram. It had to show that everybody had been notified, that they had signed off and said this change will not impact us, or the impact has been documented. But where's Print Spooler? I mean, it's a third-party tool and a third-party tool that could be being used indirectly by other third-party tools, all of which may be under your control. So what's the impact? A lot? Well, maybe, maybe not. I mean, is it just local? Does the patch break Fufu Cam software that uses DongleMania.exe, which uses Print Spooler as a buffering mechanism for report generation? And when DongleMania crashes due to some unknown issue, it also crashes Fufu Works, and our Mr. Tingly robots all pick up plungers and start wailing, exterminate. I mean, I don't even want to imagine how long that would take to analyze or what those meetings would be like. I mean, in that old world model, you know, the software would be obsolete at an end of life before you ever got through the process the first time. So, you know, it creates, it's created a problem, and it's a problem that's getting worse. It's an environment that's almost inconceivable in that old amount of Sue doing a commit. So at the time, we shifted, at the same time, we've shifted from that very naive world where we push out final products that aren't full of bugs, and I know we did, but we at least kidded ourselves that we weren't, to, well, you know, let's just kick it out there. It booted up. We'll turn it loose and let people report problems, and we'll debug the betas. I mean, that's why everything works today, right? So that just about guarantees that you're going to have a lot more problems that are rapidly approaching the singularity of every single commit in the world, causing a ripple through the whole world. I mean, the same firmware we're using in Mr. Tingly Robots version 6.1 is used in our industrial blender software. So when the exterminate thing happens, you know, not only is it Mr. Tingly Robots, it's Mr. Tingly Robots with industrial blender hardware. I mean, you know, so, and just for the sake of consistency, I'll name our industrial blender process Frapworks or Frappyworks or something like that. Flappyworks. I mean, it's a pretty daunting problem to my aging mind, and it's not going away. It's almost like we're going to have some kind of versioning, API link chains, a tree of software that shows every of the myriad interconnected tools around the world, you know, how many of those we don't even control. And all of this, of course, adds up to delay, even more delay. And then, you know, Sue's on vacation this week and we can't commit anything until she comes back. And the minute a notice of a patch is provided, well, the whole issue becomes well known and bad actors know that's not going to go away and that everyone's not going to patch. So the bad actors pick up on the notification. And I mean, I mentioned before, an orange sized talk at Black Hat that showed some vulnerabilities in Print Spooler. And within a few minutes of that slide being available, it was already being exploited in the wild. So in this modern age of framework malware that can be quickly adapted, the bad guys are moving a lot faster than the patch committee, which meets the first Tuesday of every month unless Sue is on vacation, in which case we'll meet next month. So unfortunately, I don't have a revelation for you. I don't have some awesome solution here, and if I did, I'd bottle it up and sell it and, you know, go buy an island. But I do have a warning. You need to spend some time convincing the C-suite that this is a critical problem and that resources are going to have to be pushed to develop a plan, implement that plan, and find a way to get the patches out into the field quickly, because the infinite series of bad actors that are basically trolling the deep waters of vulnerability reporting, patch announcements, and cool Black Hat talks can roll out their updates in minutes while you're still flying home from the con and Sue has just gone on vacation to Hawaii. So, you know, guess what? And when you get home, there's a series of fires that need to be put out that make California look like a rainforest. So I don't know the answer, and all of you are probably smarter than me anyway, so someone should probably make a lot of money solving this problem, but I do accept donations and stock options, so, you know, just saying. But up in the morning with the rising sun, don't stop patching till the patching done. And, oh, and just like running through the desert in Tucson with the Army, you never get to stop running. You'd think after a couple of days, they'd be like, okay, we did that. And then every day they were like, no, let's go run. And I'm like, again? Like, we did that. All right. And on that downer, the news. Mandiant produced a report about a bug in a product called Calais, I guess, a video sharing and surveillance company. Calais is part of the Chinese device developer ThruTech, and it's a cloud-based solution for home automation devices, which includes locks, door cams, power plugs, and pretty much anything that you want to use, like video streaming on small devices. The software, they don't actually make the devices, so Calais basically sells their firmware to vendors to be used for any of these types of home automation devices the vendor wants to make, and then they have a one-stop management tool that you can use to sell this product out to your security environment or whatever. Well, Mandy had found what they called a manipulator in the middle attack, which would allow compromise of devices and could allow sniffing of the video of all those home devices. It was CVE-2021-28732. And it can only be used, according to Mandiant, if you know in advance the 20-byte ID number of the device you want. So this system uses a 20-byte ID, like a MAC address, but it's not, you know, it's not a 48-byte MAC address, but it's a 20-byte UID. So the 20-byte UID is provided to the client from a web API that is hosted by the company that built the endpoint. So there's a whole lot of players in this game. Mandy said, and I talked about this on the show last night, that brute forcing the UID was infeasible, which I would like to hear more about how they determined that it was infeasible to brute force a 20-byte ID. Maybe they shift or so. They didn't say why they said it was infeasible. But if the attacker could guess the UID or find it out somehow, well, then what happens is they can take over the stream by pretending to be the device. And they re-register the device with Kali Network. And now they are essentially the manipulator in the middle. And, you know, that basically, once Kali gets this re-registering notification, it reissues all the auth credentials for that particular device, and then they can use that to contact it as a new software management backend, and the device will begin transmitting video to your pirate network, where you can collect it there. The recommendation is that you check to see if you have a device or devices that is connected to Kali, and try to determine if it's running ThruTech software version 3.1.10 or later. You may have to contact the cloud vendor of the device to even find this information out, and even they may not know. I mean, it's very convoluted. I mean, I don't mean the report, but just the whole problem is very convoluted, very modern. But according to the report, Mandy has said there are more than 80 million devices connected to ThruTech with an average monthly connection load of 1.1 billion connection. So very interesting report. The T-Mobile breach keeps growing and is now reported in at 47 million users. That includes 7.8 million current T-Mobile users and 40 million former T-Mobile customers. The story broke last week with claims made offering on the dark net, or the dark web, made that were offering to sell T-Mobile data online, even though it seemed like there was initially they weren't saying that. But Motherboard Magazine reported that the seller, who they actually say they talked with by DM, the seller denied being the attacker, but was only just offering goods for sale. You know, like that guy you go to at the pawn shop, and you're going, is that a bloody hand attached to that guitar? And they're like, you know, buddy, I don't know where they came from. I don't know how they got here. I just sell them. And, you know, but unlike the guy at the pawn shop, who says, I don't know anything, you know, about this. I don't know. Stole? I don't know if it's stolen. I don't know if it's not stolen. I just know somebody brought it in and they pawned it. And so, you know, if you want to buy it, feel free. But anyway, the seller who said they were not the attacker seemed to have an awful lot of inside information about this. So maybe they got this as the representative. They claimed they had like 100 million tuples from 100 gigabytes of stolen data. T-Mobile did finally confirm this on the 16th and then shared all the results of their initial analysis that revealed all these totals. T-Mobile said that some personal data was breached, including first and last names, birthdays, social security numbers, and driver's license numbers for a subset of the total. They did say that no PINs or passwords were compromised, but other reports did say that, I read several different stories about this week, other reports said that SIM card information like IMEIs and so forth may have been included in this data. SIM swapping, you know. But T-Mobile's offering the ubiquitous 2 years of free identity theft protection to affected customers, which is always one of my favorite things to hear. I think I have about 200 years now built up of free identity theft protection from the number of times I've been breached. I just have to go sure and make sure I turn those things off before they start automatically charging me after the 2 years is up. Then I can roll the next one in. The attack is reputedly based on a misconfigured gateway GPRS support node that was it was a testing node, and it was exposed to the internet. I mean, you know, not that I've ever done anything like that. But the seller, who is not the attacker, said that the attacker, who is not the seller, used brute force and credential stuffing on more than 100 servers, which did not have shunning or rate limiting enabled because they were being connected by this internal trusted node. And they should not have been on the internet at all, but the person was using that GPRS node to do this attack. I'm sure we'll hear more about this going forward. A bipartisan infrastructure bill is slowly grinding through Washington, D.C. and was passed by the Senate. The bill includes $1.9 billion, with a B, dollars for cybersecurity spending. And it sounded, you see that and you go, wow, that's a lot of money. But, you know, it really isn't. I mean, can you imagine what it would cost to implement actual cybersecurity plans at all of the cities, towns, dog catchers' offices, law enforcement buildings, fire departments, EMTs, local level government, and so forth, all across the United States? I mean, the article basically says this is a down payment on the total, which sounds about right. I mean, $1.9 billion probably won't even pay for the subscription fees for all the identity theft protection software that we're getting offered every time that we get breached, let alone place actual cybersecurity teams in every town in America. I mean, according to this article, there are 90,000 local governments, just government agencies in the United States, which translates to about, if you don't include all those other components, $11,000 a piece. So once that gets chopped up, everyone gets their taste and overhead and all that other kind of stuff and slush fund money and what have you that goes on. Well, you know, every town may be able to buy like a new, you know, Cat 5 cable or something, maybe. You know, they've been wanting to replace that for a while. I know I'm cynical. Not that I'm saying it's nothing. I'm just saying it's a start, but it's actually going to be a start that is going to need to keep being developed if we're going to try to protect all these antiquated, unsupported networks that exist out there in every small town in America. I mean, I don't know if I ever told you the story about the place that asked me to look at their security setup. They had a firewall that they had bought with grant money, and it was a physical hardware firewall. And brand doesn't matter because it wasn't the fault of the firewall. The cable from the border, so their border to the internet, the cable was wrapped twice around the firewall box that was sitting on an unused desk in the office, and the other end was then plugged directly into a Wi-Fi router. And I said, you know, you have to plug the cables into the firewall, right? Or it's not actually a firewall. And the town manager said, well, we tried that and it shut down as soon as we did it. So we had to disconnect it in order to stay online. I was kind of hoping maybe you'd be willing to take a little time this morning and help us set it up correctly for free. I was like, really? Great. That's just what I wanted to do. As long as we're in the government, a report was released about an attack on the U.S. Census Bureau that occurred in January 2020. The attack was a known exploit for remote access servers in Citrix environments. According to the report, the attack was discovered and stopped before anything was done by the attacker, which sounds a little suspicious to me. But the exploit that was used was CVE-2019-19781. And I think the point of this is not that another exploit happened, but that it happened to a large government agency, and Citrix released a public notice about it in December of 2019. And the agency had two meetings with the computer incident response team about the exploit. A link was provided to them with steps to mitigate the problem that was issued by Citrix. Basically, then, what happened was they never assigned anyone to fix it, so it got exploited. The official statement was that one group didn't coordinate with the team until after the attack. They did state that the attacker was successful in modifying some user account data to prepare for remote code execution. At least that was their interpretation of it. But I'm just going to quote the rest of this. The attacker's attempts to maintain access to the system by creating a backdoor into the affected servers were unsuccessful. That was their response. So they didn't patch. You know, they were warned. They had noticed. They hadn't got around to patching it because they didn't get the teams assigned. So just be warned. A flaw in UPnP and Cisco small business routers has been found with CVSS of 9.8. Basically, there's an issue with the validation of incoming UPnP traffic. And again, you know, they put the internet connection. Like, really? But it's small business stuff, you know. I mean, they don't have people to set that kind of thing up. And this can allow, if this is run, it can allow modification of the device, obviously. Remote code execution, denial of service, all the usual suspects. Cisco has recommended that users of the RV110W, the RV130, the RV130W, and the RV215W devices should disable UPnP on those devices, as they will not be issuing a patch. I mean, you shouldn't be allowing UPnP at your border to connect to these things, but even internally, this is a problem. So you need to get a handle on it. And Cisco said they're not going to patch it. We talked about it on the show some last night, too, if you want to check that out. Fortinet was frustrated with Rapid7 for breaking Fortinet's policy of allowing 90 days for response to vulnerability reports. Rapid7's William Vu found an OS command injection vulnerability in version 6.3.11 and prior of the FortiWeb devices management interface. Rapid7 said they contacted Fortinet in June and received an ACK from them on the 11th of June. Rapid7 then said that they contacted Fortinet multiple times after this about the issue and got no response, and so they followed their policy, which was to release the information after 60 days. They actually waited until 66 days. I mean, you know, Fortinet basically got upset about this and said their policy was 90 days. That they didn't understand why Rapid7 released this information prior, and Rapid7 said, look, you know, we got customers and our job is to report these things. We gave you 66 days and you didn't reply, so we just released it. Probably going to end up in court would be my guess. You know, it's going to have to determine, does your policy or someone else's policy apply when your policies differ? I mean, you know, how does this work? Can a company, call it Google Face, pass an internal policy that says you can't do this? I pass a policy and say I can do that, and then Google Face can claim I violated a policy? Well, they can, kind of. But whose policy is valid in the eyes of the court? When do these policies need to be passed? Who approves them? How are they applied? I mean, definitely a court case, but there's probably already a precedent on stuff like this, because I can't believe somebody hasn't tried it before. It's in some other venue. It's definitely, you know, somebody passed a policy and somebody else passed a different policy, and then it had to be determined by the court. Microsoft released the first official ISOs for Windows 11. Yesterday, the Insider Preview build 22,000.132 was made available on the Windows Insider Preview download page. It does require you to sign up to get to the page if you want to do this. The official release date for Windows 11 is October or November. I haven't actually installed it yet, but the reviews I've seen are kind of mixed, which is pretty typical for any new OS until it gets out in the field. But anyway, there's a link in the article if you're interested in playing along with any of this. And finally, really, this is OnlyFans, which, if you're unawares, I mean, I've never been to the site. Right. I haven't. I've never been to OnlyFans. My wife wouldn't like it, and not that, you know, that she would be that upset if, you know, I was doing research or something. But I've just never been to it. But I do know what it is. But it is a site that allows performers or content producers, as they're called, of all ilk, to offer services via a camera. I bet it's mostly used for discussions about recursive spooky entanglements in quantum computing. Right. But probably not. Basically, OnlyFans is a site where people take off their clothes and other people subscribe to see them take off their clothes. Sound familiar? The site was created kind of a gig economy based model for cam workers. And so instead of what the tradition was somebody hires people, they go sit in a trailer house out in the San Fernando Valley somewhere and put up cams and get watched by other people online. This one allows content producers to sign in, create content, and develop their subscriber base by doing, I guess, what the subscribers want. And then they get paid by the view, I guess. I don't actually know what the monetization model for OnlyFans is. But basically, they've been very successful at it. And anyone could do it. So if I want to become an OnlyFans person and I want to set up a cam and go on OnlyFans and do the news or whatever, or take off my clothes, I don't know who would pay to see that. But the net revenue was $375 million last year, and they have 120 million subscribers. OnlyFans claims to have paid out $3.2 billion to its content creators since the founding of it. But due to credit card companies' increased requirements, a lot of this around sex trafficking and things like that, and abuse, they have the credit card companies have required now that sites that are using their services provide some kind of moderation of content and verification requirements for any content creators to keep, you know, people from doing horrible things. Because people will do horrible things. OnlyFans announced, this was the sort of funny part of it, I guess, they announced that they will put new limits in place on the site that will no longer allow sexually explicit content, but nudity would still be allowed. So I was like, wait a minute, what? So they're going to, I guess they're going to lower it to an R rating from whatever it's rated now. But they said that nudity would be allowed if it is within their guidelines. And that's the news wrap up for the week of 15 August 2021 in the, you know, now all new time of plague, or plague 2.0, as we like to call it. Go get your vaccine, please, and patch your servers.
See ya.